The night's hall, gentlemen,
is $2 million.
Yeah, I like the sound of that.
I love you, Joe. I might want you to take me away right now. Let's go.
Tell you what. If it's a high card, I'll tell you who I am. And if it's a low card, I'll tell you who you are. Is that a deal?
Joker.
I was in this con once before. Backfired.
He's wired! It's a setup!
Bad. 60 grand a carat.
Lawless.
It's $9 million worth for the price of it.
You have seduced me. Jake.
Someone's trying to kill me, man!
Looking to score big, break a young girl's heart.
What do you want?
You don't know me. I don't have anyone.
How's your pool game?
Not too good.
Ah, perfect. Perfect.
That, my friend, is poetry.
Welcome to paradise, Mr. Joe.
Anything goes wrong, kill them all.
Police! Stop it!
Tell me this is a dream I'm gonna wake up from.
Hello and welcome to The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike DiCriscio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good. I'm very excited for today's episode. This is going to be a good one.
This is going to be a good one, also a very confusing one, because I don't think either of us, know what happened in this movie.
No. Not really.
But we definitely know how we reacted to it. And today we're going to be discussing Nicolas Cage in the 1993 film Deadfall, a project that I'm convinced Cage took part in for two reasons. The first, and most important, is that Deadfall was written and directed by Christopher Coppola, Nicolas Cage's brother.
Oh, it's his brother?
His brother is the director of this movie.
Okay, that changes things.
That answers some questions, right?
Yeah, yes it does.
The second reason is that Deadfall gives Cage the opportunity to be certifiably insane.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is a next-level Cage performance.
Yeah, this is beyond Vampire's Kiss, and
yeah,
it's out of control.
It is nuts. The only person in this movie who seems to know what Cage is doing is Cage himself. like his character, Eddie, is, one of the most erratic, offbeat, oddball creations in, cinema history. And that comes through entirely in Cage's performance. It's not there in the script.
I hope not.
I don't think it's there in the script. I don't think it's there in, his dialogue. I think it's the way that Cage, sells everything that he's doing. It's completely, dialed up to 11 when this movie's, dialed at a 5.
Yeah.
You know?
Let's save that.
Definitely going to talk about Cage a lot. This is the 20th movie we've watched for The Complete Works so far.
Wow.
So happy anniversary, Mike. Actually, thanks, man. We started about a year ago. It was June 2015. So, you know, woo.
There you go.
Happy anniversary. So we've seen plenty of crazy Cage before, right? We're pretty used to it by now. But this isn't like Vampire's Kiss, where the plot of that movie is built around Cage going crazy, right?
Right.
And it's not like Honeymoon in Vegas, where Cage's craziness is kind of amped up to match the craziness around him.
Right.
Right. This is pure unfiltered Cage. In a relatively straightforward, though increasingly weird, crime drama.
Yeah. This is Cage, which when you say it's his brother, it's almost like he did it to spite him, it feels like. the rest of this movie is not very good, but albeit it's just, like you said, a crime drama. It's about con artists and, twisty plots and stuff. And then there's just, Cage over here by himself doing this other movie that no one else is in.
Right. And I think part of me is Cage might have recognized the movie that was happening around him was not that good.
Right? Oh, I see.
So he might have decided to run with it. And since it was his brother's movie, it was fine, whatever. His brother was probably cool with it and he could just go nuts. but it is weird. Even if you look at the cover of the movie, the box art for Deadfall, Cage's character just looks like Cage. Normal-looking Cage on the box art. Yeah. So In the movie, Cage has this weird wig and a pencil-thin mustache, and he has, like, bronzer on all over his face.
Yeah, and, like, a prosthetic nose to make it pointy. It's right. Really weird.
And, of course, he's doing a weird voice, because obviously it's Cage.
Yep.
But the box art is just a picture of, like, regular Nicolas Cage.
That's why did they make that before they made the movie?
I don't know. He also gets top billing on the box art, and he's, like, directly in the center, as if he's the star of the movie. But he's only in maybe 40 minutes of it.
Yeah.
Thereabouts. I mean, he is a very significant role for the time that he's on there, but it's mostly Michael Biehn's movie. Like, yeah. He's the star. Deadfall was not well received. if our conversation so far hasn't given it away. It holds a very distinctive 0% rating in Rotten Tomatoes.
Man, that's so impressive.
Right? I mean, very few movies can garner 0%. And to be fair, there's only 5 reviews logged in for this movie on Rotten Tomatoes. But still.
But nobody gave it 1%.
Nobody gave it that one bit. And in fact, a lot of critics highlight Cage as the only reason to watch this movie.
Yeah.
It was made on a budget of $10 million. It made about $18,000.
Oh, man. Wow.
Yeah. This movie came and went. Like, I can't imagine it would play in wide release.
You know? Yeah, no. Somehow, surprisingly, this movie's on demand on Showtime, though.
Right. Yeah, that's
idea how.
Yeah, it's actually, like, relatively available. Because it's, like, I got it through my DVD plan through Netflix, which I've had a tougher time getting, like, more well-known movies.
Right.
Through the DVD plan on Netflix. And this was, and you were able to watch it on demand on Showtime, which is nuts. Like, why is this movie the one?
I don't know.
That we can get to so easily. But, you know, if not for Cage's performance, Deadfall would likely be completely forgotten. Yeah. I very much doubt you'd be able to watch it on Showtime if Cage wasn't in this movie.
Yeah, this if it wasn't for the, you know, the reason this podcast exists, for the insanity of Nicolas Cage, that obsession as a culture, I think this movie would be gone.
Right, exactly. It would be relegated to a couple of YouTube clips and like that.
And that's it.
Yeah, the film stars Nicolas Cage as Eddie, alongside the likes of Michael Biehn, Sarah Trigger, James Coburn, Peter Fonda, Mickey DeLenz, Talia Shire, and Charlie Sheen, among others. It's actually a pretty fantastic cast.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Like, for 1993, that's a pretty stacked cast.
Yeah, for like a direct-to-DVD quality movie.
Right, exactly. You
know? The IMDb plot synopsis, this is a user-submitted IMDb plot synopsis, although it's actually, I think, one of the best ones we've had. This is a not too long, not too short, you know, it tells you everything you need to know about the movie.
All right.
So let's hear it. After he accidentally kills his father, Mike, during a sting, Joe tries to carry out Mike's dying wish by recovering valuables that Mike's twin brother Lou stole from him years earlier. But Uncle Lou is also a con artist, and Joe is soon drawn into his increasingly dangerous schemes.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good plot synopsis there.
Yeah, that tells you the plot of the movie. It's not like weirdly vague like most of IMDb plot synopsis, and it's not like ridiculously detailed like a lot of the user submitted ones are. This is like right in the middle. So good job, whoever wrote this one. I could have looked that up, but I didn't.
But they most definitely listened to the show. So
absolutely, if you're taking the time to write a user submitted plot synopsis of Deadfall, there's a chance you're listening to a podcast about Nicolas Cage.
Correct.
That's the way I see it. Christopher Coppola has directed a number of films since, actually, including a movie called G-Men from Hell. That's his most well-known work as a director. It's not a well-known movie, but it's like...
well-known? That's a pretty strong term.
But he is more known for his work as a digital entrepreneur. In 2006, he launched a digital film festival known as PAH Fest, which stands for Project Accessible Hollywood Fest, and he's taken that to multiple cities across the globe. Deadfall's co-writer, Nick Vallelonga, was a Coppola family friend. At 12 years old, he was an extra in The Godfather during the wedding scenes. Yeah, that's something. and he's had his own writing and directing career since then. So, this is Deadfall. Mike, give me your overall thoughts on Deadfall.
Having laid out the relationships of the people who created it, this is very much a, let's make a movie with some friends, like, but in your backyard.
Right.
This is a story, that someone who thinks they know what it's like to be a grifter and con man would come up with. That's about as deep as the plot goes, is like, we're con men, so we con people. And then that's kind of it.
We do, yeah.
But somehow, I mean, I guess it's really the script's fault. Because, like we said, it's got a pretty good cast. And, like, James Coburn's doing... I think he's acting circles around everyone in the room.
Yeah, he's... I mean, just, James Coburn has a dual role here. He plays both Mike and Lou.
Right.
And Lou is the one he does most of the movie. But Mike is kind of, like, bookends the film. Right. Yeah, he's doing, like... I think most people in this movie are, like... It seems like they're just kind of having fun. Like, they're kind of just phoning it in a little bit.
Yeah, that's true.
Coburn is doing a solid job, and Cage is not phoning in at all.
Well, that's a good point. Cage isn't sleepwalking. I don't know what he's doing.
He's genuinely giving it his all, I think. There's a lot of energy in Nicolas Cage's performance.
There is, you're right.
And we're gonna...
I can't even, I don't know what to worry, I can't worry about Nicolas Cage.
We have to gather our thoughts about Cage, so we're going to get to the other stuff first, and then talk Cage. So yeah, Coburn's doing a good job. I thought Michael Biehn was very flat in the role.
He was, yeah.
And I normally really like Michael Biehn. You know, he was in The Terminator, and he was in Aliens. He, you know, he's James Cameron's buddy. But in this movie, I felt, especially his voiceover narration, I thought was so boring.
Yeah, it reminded me of, I think he does voiceover in Terminator, right?
I believe so, yeah. Sure. Yeah, he does.
It was kind of like, yeah, we'll write him some voiceover stuff because he did it in Terminator, is how that stuff felt.
Yeah.
Where he was just, like, standing there reading the words on the page, and he's sad because he's a con man. And, like, that's kind of it.
Yeah, but it feels like he's just reading it for the first time. Like, he's kind of just, like, reading it in, like, a monotone voice. You know, and all the things that he has to read are, like, these generic platitudes.
They are, like, and it's very much anything. Just, like, we couldn't figure out how to get this point across, so... You could read it in the voiceover.
Yeah, but like the movie starts and he's like, you know, sometimes I think at this point in the life you think maybe you'll have control of your life, but that's not how it goes right now. And then and he just keeps going like these generic things that like, yeah, I could have written that. Like,
right, that's what I, yeah, absolutely. And it's very expository, like explaining relationships between people.
Yeah.
Like you have to, this movie is just all over is bad. my favorite, lame directing choice or editing choices. So we get the Lou turns around and we see that it's his, the twin brother of the guy of the, you know, of his father.
Right.
And we have to, we flash back to see the father die as if like, we couldn't tell that it's still James Coburn. Like,
and he had died like 5 minutes earlier.
Yeah. Like what? Yeah, I wouldn't ever, well, my exact note was, yes, we needed a flashback to James Coburn from the beginning to realize that it's James Coburn now. but there's a lot of stuff like that in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about Charlie Sheen.
Okay.
You know, he has a relatively small role in this movie, but he is super memorable.
He is. Go ahead, Mike.
Now, he comes in, like, towards the end as, like, this pool shark.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kind of reminded me a little bit of Racing with the Moon for a second, because it's like, yeah, there's this pool, this little pool segment of the movie that's just a pool thing. And then, you know, Michael Biehn loses to him. But Charlie Sheen is wearing, like, this red pinstripe suit. He has, like, a devil goatee and, like,
yep.
You know, I think I said that he, we both had, like, notes for this, like, we are comparing him to other things. I said that he looks like a Saturday morning cartoon version of the devil.
Which is beautiful. I didn't even realize that. I didn't even put that together. But for me, my note was that it's the darkest timeline for this Charlie Sheen. Because he has his hair all slicked back. He's got a pointy mustache and goatee.
Right.
And he's got, like, one hand with finger gloves on.
Yeah, that was... I took special note of that glove. Because that glove had three fingers.
Yep.
And two, like, open spots that just didn't have fingers. And it's like, either you have finger gloves or you have no finger gloves. Like, there's no...
Yeah, it was very...
At most, you have, like, a four-finger glove.
Right.
You know? Like, a three-finger glove? I've never seen that before. That is ridiculous.
It was bizarre. But I feel like even the inclusion of this pool shark scene feels like the, oh, it's a con man movie.
So we have that pool shark scene.
Yeah, because it... This movie felt like it was years long for me. It has a full arc, like climax and resolution, almost a resolution, and then there's still 40 minutes left.
Yeah, no, it definitely, it feels like the movie's going, and there's a part, I felt this movie was kind of like oddly compelling to me. Okay. Not because I really liked it, but because it was just kind of like really fascinating to watch. Like, how did this happen? Like,
yeah, that's true.
Why is what I'm watching right now?
Right.
You know?
Yep.
The movie starts and, you know, it's kind of boring in the beginning. And then Cage gets introduced.
Right.
And it's still kind of boring, but you're kind of fascinated by what Cage is doing. And then you see Cage, like, gradually get more and more insane. And I was right there with it. I was, like, into the movie.
Yeah.
Because of that reason. And then I guess we'll get into this. Cage dies.
Right.
And it seems like, oh, well, that's the end of the movie. Because this seems like to be the climax. This is, like, this is everything the movie's been about up to this point.
Right. Most of the tension in the plot at that point was between the relationship between Cage's character and Michael Biehn's character.
Yeah, because they're both after the same girl, Sarah Trigger.
Right.
And then Cage dies by getting his face in a frying machine.
Deep fryer.
Deep fryer.
There you go,
which was ridiculous and I just thought of this now, could be a reference to his role in Fast Times at Ridgemont High with the fried cook in the background of a scene.
Sure, yeah, we could go with that. We'll put that in there.
Could be a subtle shout out. But then, you know, Cage dies, and it seems like the movie's about to end, because that's, like, logically the end point.
Yeah.
And then there's another 40 minutes of this plot that I had kind of forgotten about, and it seemed like the movie had forgotten about. And it just kind of adds, like, convolution upon convolution, and it makes no sense.
Right.
You know, and then there's a twist at the end, which is like, what? But also, like, that makes no sense either. So, yep. The twist at the end, of course, is that Biehn's father, Mike, played by James Coburn, has been alive this whole time, and it was actually conning everyone else.
Right, he was conning the brother.
Yeah, and then they're on a carousel, and then there's just a whole thing with the carousel. And the carousel goes, and, like, the money gets dropped, and then Michael Biehn walks away.
Yep, and he says some platitude, and then the credits roll.
Yeah.
It's very weird.
It was completely bizarre. I had no idea what I was watching at any given time in this movie.
Nope.
And I haven't even gotten into Angus Scrimm's character, who has a robot arm that is also a giant scissor.
Yeah, so
I can't even believe I'm saying that sentence.
and it's real. You're not making it up.
Yeah.
Well, so the first act, I don't even know, 40 minutes, whatever, up to when Cage dies, is, like we said, crazy, weird, doesn't really make any sense. But it is kind of logical to some extent. We're in this weird world with the con men and this crazy, insane, druggy character that is Nicolas Cage. But then we shift to, like B-movie James Bond, and we get, like... We get him with a gold and, like, crystal lobster claw hand.
Yeah.
That thing. And, like, he's in this weird room with, like, crystals and, like, people in leather. And, like, I don't even understand what's going on. It makes this huge shift to this other genre that feels like this weird 90s underground idea of what criminals are. And I don't know. It's very odd.
It is bizarre. And, I mean, like... I am all for a random lobster claw robot arm. Like, that's...
Are you, though?
I am! Like, I am a fan of just absolute ridiculousness, and I enjoy...
True.
And, like, if it was, like, a better movie, I'd be like, wow, that's so cool. you know, but I think part of the problem is that they get this guy, you know, this robot lobster arm, and then they don't have him do anything with it.
Yeah.
Like, why didn't he chop some guy's head off or something? Do something cool.
Right.
Like, if you're gonna go the extra mile and have a robot lobster arm on this secondary antagonist,
right?
Why not have him, like, use it?
That's a good point.
Why does he just have it? Like, why can't he, you know, attack somebody with it? Like, show how he's a menace to the protagonist. Let's show him, like, cut through somebody's heart or something. And it's a relatively violent movie. Like, it's rated R, I think. Like, it could do it.
At this point, yeah. And also, we get the threat of that. He's like, oh, how did you know I wasn't going to snip your fingers off? And he's like, I didn't. And, like, he's supposed to be all confident and badass about it. But then also, every time that we see the arm on screen, it's accompanied by, like, whirring and gears turning and, like, like the Saturday morning version of what a robot sounds like. Yeah. And it really undermines him as a character.
Yeah, no, it's incredibly, incredibly silly. Yeah. Let's talk about the relationship, like the love triangle that's going on between Bean, Cage, and Sarah Trigger's character. Now, I think the movie was actually trying to draw like a parallel between their love triangle and the love triangle of Michael Bean's father, uncle, and his mother.
Right.
Right, that was kind of like the idea that they were going for. And I could see that in certain scenes. Like, it kind of made sense and kind of was like, oh, Michael Bean is just another version of his father and, like, he's falling into the same patterns and stuff.
Yeah.
But the movie doesn't do anything with that. It just kind of, like, introduces the idea and says, like, yep, that's as far as we got. Yeah. What did you think of, Sarah Trigger's character and how everybody interacted with her?
Just kind of why. Mostly. there's a lot of things in this movie.
I mean, her betrayal at the end of the movie felt like a cheat to me.
Well, we get there's like a reveal. I may even be not remembering this right. But so that we have like this 45, that's too big of an exaggeration. We have this really lengthy sex scene.
You should say 45 minutes.
Yeah. I couldn't even do it.
It is one of the most gratuitous sex scenes I've ever seen.
For me, it was on the level of The Room.
It is The Room. It's like MacGruber, but without the irony.
Yeah.
Like, at any point, like, I was expecting the music to cut out. Just, like in MacGruber, you just hear the grunting. Like,
Yeah, it goes on for way too long. It's very odd. I don't even remember if that's after that is when she says the platitude that we know Mike said with the leave the past for those that are stuck in it or something like that.
Right.
Which, like, clearly means that she knew Mike if like, he said that all the time. True. But that, like, and then there's, like, another half hour of the movie before we find out, like, oh, they're working together. It's, like, yeah. It's pretty obvious. And, like, even Michael Bane's character doesn't put it together. I don't get it. I thought that was going to be, like, a huge, like, oh, my God, betrayal. He puts it all, the things all fall into place. But, like, nah.
It's like an afterthought.
Yeah, the movie doesn't go anywhere with it.
Yeah, but it's weird because I feel like the movie doesn't set up the betrayal that well. Like, I guess you mentioned that platitude thing, which I didn't catch on, so, you know.
But that's because it doesn't do anything with it.
It doesn't do anything with it. And it kind of just sets her up as this, like, pawn that's dating Nicolas Cage and then starts sleeping with Michael Bean. And that's kind of the crux of the movie's drama for most of it.
Yeah.
For everything having to do with Cage. It's like, it's about her.
Yeah.
Then after Cage dies, like, she's still with Michael Bean and she's still just with him. And there's no hint or anything that she has betrayed him in any way. And then at the end of the movie, she just shows up during Mike's con and is like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm here too.
We almost get, she almost gets like a tiny hint of agency, but then it's not given to her. Like, I don't like, cause she mentions that she's just using Eddie, Nicolas Cage's character, like, to climb the ladder. Like, she's, you know, she's had a dozen of Eddies before, something like that, she says. But turns out she's just Mike's pawn, I guess. Like, I don't even know. Or she's Lou's pawn? It doesn't make any sense.
Nothing makes sense. This whole movie is, like, one convoluted, like, nonsense ball. Yeah. But there's, like, I enjoyed a lot of aspects about it just because it's so, like, I think it is on the level of, like, The Room where, you know, it's so bad that I feel like I can enjoy it on a certain level that it's, like,
That's definitely true.
One thing I did enjoy was the, there's the con they pull off in the bar, where they, which was, like, I saw them do that and I think Talia Shire was the bartender, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right, and they con her out of $200, right?
Right.
And make her think she's getting $500. And it was a lot like cons that I have seen done so much better on Better Call Saul.
That's a really good point.
Like, individual episodes of that show have made me, like, super invested in those kind of cons.
Yep.
And then to see it done in this movie, it felt like such, like, so undercooked and so, like, very, like, easy, like, so she was so easily conned into this thing.
Yeah, there's almost no believability into anyone falling for these things.
Right.
There's one of the other, you know, the silly directing choices. So we get Nicolas Cage's character. I don't know if we want to go into him. I mean, we kind of already have.
Right.
We hang when Michael Biehn's character and meets Lou, the uncle, for the first time. We see Nicolas Cage's character sit on the couch, and he like pulls his sunglasses off, and he's like his eyes are red and swollen, and I don't know what's going on there.
Yeah.
But we hang on him for a really long time as he's like taking pills and stuff while the plot is progressing in the conversation. Like we can hear Lou and Michael Biehn's character talking, and the plot is progressing, and they're talking about what happened with Mike and.
Yep.
Stuff, but we get to watch Nicolas Cage do whatever the fuck he's doing.
Right. It positions Cage to be like a much more important character in this movie than he is.
Right.
Because again, he's significant for the amount of time he's there, but after he's gone, he has no impact on this plot whatsoever.
None.
And he's gone with 40 minutes left of the movie. I don't understand why they would kill him off so early. He is the best part about this movie.
Yeah.
Like there had to be some knowledge that this wasn't that great of a movie.
I would hope so.
Right? And so I feel like you should just like embrace that, get all the Cage nonsense that you can into this movie. But even so, I did. So Cage as a character has a tendency to call everyone man. Like he would say man at the end of every sentence.
Yeah.
And I thought that was like a character tick or whatever. But then at the end of the movie, James Coburn as Mike has like a big speech to Michael Biehn's character on the carousel, and he does the same thing where he just keeps saying "man,"
oh yeah,
over and over again, like "man, you don't get it, man."
Yeah,
this is a con, man, and it completely like it felt like what's like every like tick that James Coburn had before then is completely out the window, and just feels like he's a different character all of a sudden.
Well, I mean, he literally is.
Well, yeah, okay. You know what? That's fair. But there was no like evidence that his other character had talked like that either. And why would he talk the same way that Cage talked?
Right. You know? It's very weird.
But yeah, let's really get into Cage, because this is a bizarre performance from Nicolas Cage. This is genuinely the most questionable performance like I've seen of that we've done so far. I think this is like, you know, we started this podcast and we were like, we're gonna see some crazy Cage. I'm excited about it.
Right.
This made me question everything I've ever felt.
Yeah.
Everything I ever wanted from Cage. Like this is like, I mean, I loved it. Like I loved his performance in this movie. It is like just so entertaining to watch on every level, I think.
Yeah.
But it's, like, genuinely, like, I texted you as I was watching it, and I was like, I genuinely have no idea what the fuck Cage is doing in this movie.
None. I get no this acting decision that he makes for the 40 minutes approximately that he's in this movie has any basis in reality.
Yeah, none of it makes any kind of sense. And apparently, I was looking at the IMDb page. So Cage's character has a very distinctive way of dressing. He has, like, a wig. He's got these albino contact lenses and dark sunglasses. And apparently he just showed up to set that day dressed like that.
Wow.
Because he thought it would add more authenticity to the character of Eddie.
What?
That is what goes on in Cage's mind.
That's impressive.
Yeah, that is insane. I guess, like, Christopher Coppola gave him, like, free reign to dress up however he wanted for the part, and he just ran with it. You know, it's a lot like Wild at Heart. Like Cage suggested the snakeskin leather jacket.
Right.
Right. But that was a great movie. so it's a little different.
Yeah.
And that's a bonkers performance from Cage too, Wild at Heart. But that also fits the tone that movie's going for.
Exactly. That's the thing about this.
Yeah.
The movie is going for such a dramatic, serious take on the con man story,
at least at first. I feel like that unravels very quickly.
That's true.
Around the time Charlie Sheen shows up and there's a guy with a robot arm, that goes out the window.
but yeah, that's a very good point. But like, that's what I mean. And then it does things that unravel that very quickly.
Yeah, it's like it's a relatively down to earth movie, and then Cage shows up, dials everything up to 11. And then Cage dies, and the movie has to, like, play catch-up to where Cage had dialed back up to.
Yeah, and then we get a robot guy.
And then we get a guy with a robot arm, for no reason. It's so weird. Yeah. That's it. I can't say don't watch Deadfall, because it does have a great Cage performance, and it has a guy with a robot arm. So
yeah, I mean, watch the first 40 minutes. It's pretty worth it.
Yeah, a first hour, because that's when Cage dies.
First hour, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. Or, like, Cage doesn't show up until, like, 20 minutes in. So, like, that 40-minute chunk, watch. And then maybe just see some YouTube videos of the guy with the robot arm. Yeah. But let's talk about some of our favorite Cage scenes in this movie, because there's just, I mean, as he's learning that Sarah Trigger and Michael Biehn are having a relationship,
yeah,
like, the progression of intensity in his performance is, like, a sight to behold.
Yeah, it's more of like a train wreck. He starts off, well, the first, you know, as soon as he appears and he talks, it's like, oh, we're getting another Nicolas Cage voice decision. This is interesting, because it's like a, like, his mouth doesn't move and he just kind of talks through gritted teeth with, like, a weird mumble. And then, like we talked about, his awful wig and weird mustache. But let's see, my favorite, well, there's the freak out.
Right.
But I feel like that's a whole separate thing that we can talk about.
The classic freak out, yeah.
Yeah.
But even, just like, just from the moment he shows up, like, just the way he says certain words, like, yeah, when they're at the bar and he's like, I would like a glass of some champagne.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very...
Or he's talking to Michael Biehn and he's calling him his friend. Like,
oh man, I didn't even realize, like, put that together, what he's actually saying there. Because, like, there's a lot of moments where it's just like, I can't even figure out what he's talking about.
It's like he has, like, peanut butter in his mouth or something, and he's, like, trying to, like, form words that, like, he can't form.
Can't do it. He's got a mix of peanut butter and cocaine in his mouth. Very odd.
Yes. I did enjoy the subplot with Baby, who is, yes, this large black man who runs the strip club, I guess.
I guess.
I just enjoyed the fact that Michael Biehn, like, just used his own money. And, like, like, the result of that plot I thought was kind of funny. Where,
yeah,
Cage shows up as, like, well, how come you gave him the money and not me? And he's like, I didn't give him the money. He told me that my debt was cleared if I showed up and gave him a hug outside.
Yep. Yeah, I do, like, love that. That I was going to say, the freak out at the strip club is probably my favorite.
Yeah.
But besides the one that's in all of the compilations of Nicolas Cage freakouts.
Right. There's also, I mean, there's just some killer Cage lines in these freakouts. I mean, there's a big fight scene at the strip club, right?
Oh, if it's a big fight scene. Oh, actually, there is outside.
He gets into a fight and he's just shouting, yeah, like, hi, fucking ya! Yeah. All over the place.
Yeah, well, wait, hold on. It's even better than that. Like, the progression. So he finds out that Michael Biehn's character screwed him with Baby. So he, like, gets up and he's like, flips a table over and no one does anything. So he yells, no one does anything. He grabs a drink and throws it in some guy's face. And then he keeps walking.
Yeah.
And then some guy walks in the door and, like, bumps into to Nicolas Cage's character, and then he starts to punch him and yells, hi fucking yeah.
Hi fucking yeah.
And then goes outside and there's more fights.
Right.
It's bizarre. Yep. Everyone's just sitting there like, oh yeah, this is what happens here.
Yeah, and it's also that amazing line. I think is it Cage shouting, who sent ya? Or is Cage shouting, Sam fucking Peckinpah?
No, Cage is shouting, who sent you, when he tries to be assassinated. Or when someone tries to assassinate him.
Right. And the guy who he kills the guy, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah, the guy shouts, Sam fucking Peckinpah! Yeah. Which, and of course, Sam Peckinpah was a movie director who directed movies like The Wild Bunch and Straw Dogs. Yeah. Totally a random name to shout out.
It doesn't make any sense.
And that actually, that forms the chorus for a song called Deadfall, which is based on this movie by this punk band named Snot. It was... Like, 4 years after this movie came out, this punk band, Snot, just wrote a song recapping the entire plot of Deadfall. Much like Sir Mix-a-Lot's rap at the end of Amos and Andrew.
If only that was at the end of this movie, it might be good.
Yeah, I mean, that was the Mix-a-Lot song was sanctioned for the movie. This was just, like, I guess a fan was a part of this band and wrote the song.
And wrote the song.
Yeah. So there's a song called Deadfall by this band called Snot. I'll probably play some of it as the as we finish up this episode. But that is the chorus of that song, is Who Sent You, Sam Fucking Peckinpah? Who Sent You, Sam Fucking Peckinpah? Yeah. Which is pretty great. And yeah, let's talk about Cage's death scene.
Sure.
Which is ridiculous. Like, absolutely. What, like, that's... Like, as Cage has gone off the deep end at this point, right? He's doing his big freak out. He shows up at Sarah Trigger's place and, like, shouts at her. And then he's going after Michael Bean and they fight each other.
Flopping around on the bed.
Flopping around. There's one point where, Michael Bean has Cage, like, he has him. Like, he's about to kill him. Yeah. And then Cage says the word motherfucker, but it's dubbed.
Really?
Did you not catch that?
No.
There was one point in that fight scene where this Cage is like, motherfucker, but his mouth doesn't like match up with the word.
That's awesome.
That he's saying. That happens again later in the movie too. I don't remember exactly I don't remember the exact word like phrase, but it was during like the scene where like all the during the one last job heist guys are getting together for like the big thing. There's like a round table where the camera's just constantly circling around without cutting. And like, at one point, some guy says something, and his mouth does not match the words coming out of it at all.
That's awesome. During Cage's freakout, he goes and ties up Lou, James Coburn.
Right.
And James Coburn keeps saying, "What's gotten into you? What is this?" As Nicolas Cage is, like, just making baby noises at, like, he's just like, like, it's very weird.
Yep.
And that to me felt exactly like James Coburn was like actually asking Nicolas Cage, like, what are you doing?
What is going on here?
What is going on?
I think the best part of that whole death scene for Cage is that his wig comes off and he's revealed to be bald.
Like, that's a big plot point.
Like, what? Like, why is this a thing? Like, why did this happen?
Yeah.
And then, of course, Michael Biehn stuffs Nicolas Cage's face into the deep fryer. Yeah. And that's how he dies. And then there's 40 minutes left of the movie. And I actually like paused the movie just to see how much longer there was. And I wrote down 40 minutes. like I was shocked. And then I saw your notes and you wrote the exact same thing.
Yeah. Yep. Very, very odd. But we also, and then like we get a very gratuitous, I mean, the movie is kind of violent, I guess when Nicolas Cage kills the assassin. We get a very gratuitous shot of his throat slit.
Yes.
With, like, Mike and Ike's falling everywhere. Not Mike and Ike's. What's the really shitty ones? They're purple and white. that character eats the whole movie for some reason.
Okay.
Well, anyway. You know what I'm talking about.
Sure, yeah.
But then Nicolas Cage gets his face fried, and we get, Michael Biehn pulls him out of the fryer and then like almost pushes his face into the camera. Like we get a really weird forced close up of what his fried face looks like.
Yeah. I saw that there was 40 minutes left and I was convinced for a little while that Cage would somehow come back. Like he would be resurrected somehow. Cause the movie was so weird at this point. I was like, all right, let's go with it.
Yeah.
But I was kind of disappointed to find that he didn't.
That would have been nice. He comes back just looking like Jason.
Yeah, like having like the burned up face, wanting revenge for getting his face burned or something.
For having his toupee ripped off.
Yeah, exactly. That was bizarre. Is there any other scenes you want to talk about, Mike? Anything specific about Deadfall that you wanted to get into?
We find out the job, the one last job is the same job as the first job.
Yep.
But I like the scene right before that scene, the one that you were talking about with the round table and the camera and the spinning. Michael Biehn's character walks past like the donut stand, and the girl's like trying to flirt with him a little bit, which happened the first time. You know, it's pretty obvious she's got a crush on him or something. And then the pizza guy who we've never talked to.
I had notes about that too, actually.
Yeah. Okay, good.
The pizza guy has a crush on the waitress. He's going to die. Now we know this one bit of character information, so we feel connected to him. He's going to get murdered.
My note is, got to give the pizza guy a crush so when he dies later, we feel bad. Oh, man. I'm so proud of us, Mike.
Same wavelength. Oh, man. Did he die later? I feel like he did,
I think he did.
Yeah. I don't even remember.
I think he's the first one that gets shot.
Right. But it's in such, like a lot of people die in that thing. Like, he's kind of lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
So there was no point in giving us, like, an introduction to him. Because, it's a meaningless death.
And it happens so late. Like, we see him the very first time Michael Biehn's character shows up in, like, that little marketplace.
Right.
But then he doesn't talk. He gets no lines of dialogue until he tells us that he has a crush on the donut girl. And it's like, oh, well, you're pretty obviously about to die.
Right. It's like, do you remember we reviewed The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2, and there was, like, the one character who's like, oh, I have a twin, and he's my best friend, and we're friends, and, like, everybody loves us. And then they die, like, a scene later. Now that we know this, like, information about them, and they have somebody they care about.
Yeah. That's exactly what this is. Oh, man. Yeah, I just wanted to bring that up because it's hilarious.
That was that was pretty amazing. Yeah. All right. That's I think that about sums up our thoughts on Deadfall, right? That's generally speaking. But we can get into the Netflix reviews now, which are pretty interesting.
I just want to point out that how scattered and everything our reaction to this movie is.
That is exactly how scattered the movie is.
Yeah, correct. Yep.
Yeah. All right. So let's get into some Netflix reviews for Deadfall. We've enjoyed doing this segment for the last couple of movies, and why stop now, right?
I feel like this is going to be good.
There's some good ones. There are some good ones. This is a 3-star review of Deadfall. So my friend who really enjoys terrible movies mentioned this to me, and I knew Netflix would have it on instant play since they only stream crappy movies.
This guy with the hot takes.
Yeah. Also, he calls it Netflix, which I don't know if that's a typo or intentional, but he left it in. However, I was completely unprepared for the magical movie ride that Nicolas Cage would take me on.
Wow.
One reviewer put it best by describing Cage's performance as unlike anything else I've ever seen, and I don't really know what to say. The movie gets really good at around the 53-minute mark. I started crying from laughter after I got over the shock of disbelief. Unfortunately, the movie makes no sense, has no real cohesive plot or script, and the actors get confused because the director was on drugs, possibly meth.
What? I feel like that's just editorial. Yeah. He's got no proof.
Yeah. Important warning, if you only want to see the best Nicolas Cage moments and skip everything else, please go to YouTube and type in Deadfall Nicolas Cage and click on worst movie scenes of all time. Seriously.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the 53-minute mark is around when Cage dies.
Yeah. He's, like, praising Cage, and then he's like, oh, but the movie gets great after Cage's gone.
Yeah, pretty weird.
Yeah. 5-star review. Technically, it's a bad movie, but that doesn't stop it from being awesome. Nicolas Cage is just a highlight machine, even trumping his performance in The Wicker Man.
Wow.
Any second he's on screen is worth watching. It's a con movie, so it takes a few unbelievable twists. But if you sit back and relax, you should find it enjoyable. I can't believe I haven't heard of this movie till now. It's definitely a lost B-movie classic.
I don't even know if it's B-movie. It's, like, way worse than that.
It's like a D or E movie.
Yeah.
3-star review. I am tempted to point out in the title of the movie they spelled dreadful wrong.
Oh, man, this guy's clever.
But on the other hand, it's hard to tell if they were serious. You keep watching and saying, really? 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 They did not just do that, but they did. All in all, a very good, dreadful movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That sums it up pretty well.
Good job, guy. 1-star review. I don't usually write negative reviews. If I don't like a movie, I pretty much just remove it from my queue and try another one. However, being a fan of Nicolas Cage, I had to write this. In all honesty, I thought I'd never see a Nicolas Cage movie that wasn't good.
Whoa. This person has a lot to learn.
Yeah, he calls himself a fan of Nicolas Cage. Wow, was I wrong. What were they thinking? I couldn't get past the first half hour. To say this movie was terrible doesn't seem adequate. Time's terrible by 100, and you have it. Guess I'll go find something starring Nicolas Cage that's really good now, just to remind me that he really is a great actor.
Oh no, we don't want to ruin this guy's whole life philosophy.
I know, right? It totally took him for a loop. Here's a 5-star review.
Okay.
Everybody always mentions Nick Cage in this movie, though he is fantastic in this. But the real highlight is Angus Scrimm's giant, ridiculous robot arm.
Ridiculous? What did you mean? Did you mean to say I can't even do it?
You know what? I did not mean to say ridiculous, but I'm keeping it in because it is a ridiculous robot arm. It has to be seen to be believed. I'm still not sure whether it really happened or if I passed out in the last fifth of the movie with some kind of twisted fever dream.
Oh my god. If that guy had written ridiculous, that would have been my favorite review of all time.
All right. There's a couple more. Let's keep. We got to keep this going, Mike.
I can't. I'm crying.
All right. Here's another 5-star review. There was a surprising amount of 5-star reviews of Deadfall on Netflix. I just want to say.
Yeah, it's a whole. It's so bad. It's good.
Right. Thing. 5-star review. This movie operates on a whole different level. You know how when a person gets mad, they build up to it over several minutes, then for like 30 seconds they blow up and go insane, and then it passes? Imagine those 30 seconds sustained at the same hysterical pitch for entire scenes, so long that it transcends the mundane and enters another reality altogether, like the Twilight Zone, except it's pissing your pants hilarious. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. Okay. We can't top ridiculous.
Ridiculous. So. Ridiculous was definitely the accidental best, but there's two more reviews.
Okay.
Here's a 2-star review. The worst Nicolas Cage movie I've ever seen. I should have known 99% of the movies Peter Fonda has been in were stupid.
Whoa.
Some serious Peter Fonda hate.
Yeah, that guy's throwing some shade.
Yeah. I wonder what the 1% that he likes are.
Probably just easier.
Presumably he's seen all of them.
I guess so.
And finally, another 2-star review. Simply a mess. What the hell happened with this movie? Spoilers. The most interesting and possibly the only interesting character dies about halfway through the movie. The cover is a what the fuck all by itself. Why is Nicolas Cage front and center as if he's the main character? And not only that, why doesn't he resemble the character he played even in the slightest? It just looks like typical Cage. The hair is wrong compared to the character he played, wig or not, and he had a mustache throughout the whole movie.
That's amazing. I need to go look this up once we're done recording because yeah, I didn't see what the cover was.
Yeah, it's literally like it makes it look really generic and like it looks like a crime generic crime thriller. But Cage is like in the center of the cover, like it's his big face plastered on the cover.
God,
and it's just Cage. It looks like Cage from Face Off or something. Like
bizarre.
But anyway, that about wraps it up for the Complete Works this week. Mike, do you have any final thoughts on Deadfall?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. If you're interested, just watch it for Cage, and then just stop once he's gone, or look it up on YouTube.
I mean, I definitely think it's worth watching as like a bad movie kind of experience. Like I don't think it's the level of The Room, where The Room is like constantly hilarious, like all the way through.
Yeah,
like, it's amazing how bad The Room is, like when you're watching it. But I do think this movie is like. Its own special kind of badness that really needs to be, like, seen to be believed. But anyway, Mike, where can we find you online this week? You can
find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I stream our games at twitch.tv/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at msmithfilmblog at twitter.com. And you can find our podcast at filmbook.com, where we podcast about the Complete Works, obviously. And we do film bookcast. The official podcast is filmbook.com. Thank you for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. It's Mike DeCriscio. If you're listening to this VVR podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email because we produce so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks where we will be discussing Nicolas Cage in 1994's Guarding Tess, a movie where Cage plays a Secret Service agent who's tasked with guarding the First Lady and all the hijinks that ensue from that. So that'll be fun.
The classic comedy premise.
Yeah. And check out this week's Film Bookcast, where I'm hoping we're going to be reviewing The Conjuring 2, if, you know, Mike can handle it.
If I could work up to it. Yeah,
yeah, if you can, like, muster up the courage to go to your theater this weekend to The Conjuring 2, then that's what we'll be reviewing. If not, we'll find something else.
Yeah.
Like, if you text me and be like, oh, by the way, I saw Warcraft instead. I was too scared.
Like, by the way, I'm dead.
Yeah, so Conjuring 2, most likely. But if Mike's too scared, we'll review Warcraft. All right, thank you guys so much for listening. We are out.
Well, vive la fucking France, man!
Who sent your baby girl?